Hi and welcome to another episode of Textory. Get your tea at the ready. Today we're going to be all about the subtle and the romantic and the beautiful. So if you wanted tea today, you better brew it because it's not going to be that crazy. It's mostly going to be about the aesthetic and the beauty, which I think we need more and more these days because we don't get it from our daily lives. So let's get it from something else instead. I'm gonna get back to that in a moment, but before we get into that, did you know I have a Patreon? So for everyone that's interested in the podcast and wants to keep it going, there is a Patreon at patreon.com/textory where we have some materials, let's say, connected to the episodes, and then we have some stuff that's completely not connected to the episodes, but mostly it's about fun historical things. So you're gonna get more of that on the Patreon or at the Patreon. I don't even know what a Patreon is. I don't know what I'm doing. Anyway, let's get into this episode. So it is no news that throughout most of the history, women's access to education was severely limited, to put it mildly. I mean, education itself was only available to the higher class. And even then, the women's version of that education was very thwarted. Is that a word? So from the small amount of women that did access education, you then had the even smaller amount that decided to try writing themselves. And from that even smaller amount, the number of female written works that actually survived and have been discovered is honestly pathetic. And from the point of view of someone who's trying to study and understand history, it is double sad because these are the voices that we won't hear anymore. They have forever perished, and we will not fully recover the sort of shared experience of average women in history simply because it is just forever gone, which makes me actually a bit angry. It's like the Library of Alexandria, except women's history. And even though we may think that, you know, poetry is maybe a bit more feminine centered, it's a bit ethereal, it's, you know, it's supposed to be delicate, it's supposed to be raw, it's supposed to be emotional, actually to this day it continues to be a male dominated field. In 2005, publisher Neil Astley, not to be confused with Rick Astley, you just got Rickrolled in this podcast, he went through 70 reviews from Guardian Review. And over the span of 2 years, only 10 in 66 poetry books were written by women. I know this is over 20 years ago. This could have changed since then, probably has changed for the better, but it shows how recently there was still this disparity that even poetry was considered a man's work. I myself am not a poetry connoisseur. I was never good at reading poetry. We did some of that at school. My friends reveled in it. I was just like, I don't get what they're talking about. But I do appreciate skilled wordsmiths. And today we will be reading Women's Voices from 1887. It's really interesting because it's an anthology of poems written by English, Scotch, and Irish women that were selected by Mrs. William Sharp, so Elizabeth Sharp, who was also a writer. So she collected all these because she found them worthy to be known, but also clearly she was interested in highlighting women's voices in an era where that was maybe not the priority. I mean, 1887 is maybe not known for equality. So, Women's Voices, 1887, an anthology of the most characteristic poems by English, Scotch, and Irish women. I don't know where Welsh women went, by the way. And actually, there is one poetress in today's text that is going to be someone who fully identified as Welsh. But we'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, I have to say, reading these was like, damn, I kind of miss good poetry. I don't mean to say that modern poetry is not good, but sometimes it's just so deconstructed that it's actually too much work for me to put it back together. You know what I mean? Historical poetry was sort of the art of making words sound as beautiful as possible. And even though it might be considered conservative, like maybe it's not super groundbreaking and it's not really bringing much to the conversation. I just enjoy beauty. Sue me. I like beautiful things. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so pleasant to read, because it's just beautiful. But also to me, it was a discovery of how different the feminine voice is. I genuinely think historically, women's written works were so vastly different to the men's works. They were very introspective. They were very intricate. Honestly, they were very yummy. I love women's writing. They always delve into characters with such depth that I really find it difficult to truly immerse myself in anything that men wrote at the time, because it's just not the same. So as an example of the very yummy pieces, we have this poem by the Duchess of Newcastle. And honestly, this is the essence of mermaid core. I don't know. I can just see the iridescence, the shells, the light twinkling in the sea waves. Duchess of Newcastle, so Margaret Cavendish, she lived in the 17th century, and she's a really interesting figure because she is just so groundbreaking in so many ways you wouldn't even consider. Like, I don't mean just, oh, okay, she was a powerful woman in a time when women weren't powerful. No, she is considered by some to be a pioneer of the science fiction genre, even before Mary Shelley. She was apparently against animal testing in 17th century. Like, how crazy is that? She was also the first woman to attend a meeting at the Royal Society of London. And she was just there criticizing things and talking to people and just existing as such a trailblazing woman in 17th century is so cool. But also surprisingly, I think we sort of assume that the progress in how the society viewed women is linear. And I don't think that's the case, because obviously there were a lot of women in, let's say, 17th century or Renaissance that were considered, you know, scholars and very knowledgeable. And then by the end of the 18th century or in the 19th century, that was not the case anymore. So surprisingly, 19th century in many ways was much more oppressive than some previous eras. And obviously, mostly it's about the rich women, but also in things like owning a business, for example. Apparently 18th century and 17th century was a much better time for women as business owners than the 19th century, where it sort of waned and they weren't allowed to do that as easily anymore, or it wasn't as normalized in society. So those sort of societal changes are definitely not linear. And I think 17th century was this crazy time where women actually had something to say, and they were saying it. Margaret Cavendish published 12 original texts under her own name. And one of those texts was fascinating because it was a comedic play called Convent of Pleasure. And you're not going to guess what it was about. It was about a woman who sort of rejects the idea of marriage, and she creates a convent in which she and the other noble women can live without patriarchy. So this play is from 1668, by the way. And we're going to read a short excerpt of that play. It actually doesn't really have much to do with the plot. I just thought it's beautiful. And it's sung by Lady Happy, the main protagonist, as a sea goddess. So as I said, mermaid core to the fullest, and it actually makes me so happy that even back then, women were obsessed with the aesthetic of mermaids, because just listen to this. My cabinets are oyster shells in which I keep my orient pearls, and modest coral I do wear, which blushes when it touches air. On silvery waves I sit and sing, and then the fish lie listening. Then resting on a rocky stone, I comb my hair with fish's bone. The whilst Apollo with his beams doth dry my hair from soaking streams. His light doth glaze the water's face and make the sea my looking glass. So when I swim on waters high, I see myself as I glide by. But when the sun begins to burn, I back into my waters turn and dive unto the bottom low. Then on my head the waters flow in curled waves and circles round, and thus with eddies I am crowned. isn't this just so Barbie mermaid coded? Anyway, we're moving on to the 18th century and Mrs. Alison Cockburn, who was again such an incredible, interesting figure. I kind of want to know all these women because they sound so cool. So she was a Scottish poet, but she was actually not your typical female writer, because let's face it, most of them were born into money, were in good social position, and were allowed by the family to create. This is completely different. She was born not very wealthy. She married an impoverished advocate, and they were honestly quite poor. Like, they couldn't afford their own house, so for 4 years they stayed with her dad, who was very stern, religious man, and he thought that any kind of entertainment was a sin. So when they finally moved to Edinburgh, she was like, oh my God, I can finally breathe. And she began mixing with society. Now, here is the interesting part. It's not like being of low social status, you could just mix with rich people like that. It didn't work like that. They wouldn't allow you into their houses. It didn't work like that. But she was just that funny. She was literally so much fun to be around that she built her whole career around that. She would write fun little poems for people. She would be very witty. She was just so entertaining that people couldn't get enough of her. So they didn't care about her low social standing. They would just be like, let's invite her over because she's so much fun. She did matchmaking for fun. She made little jokes. She enjoyed good company. And good company enjoyed her, apparently. So this is one of her most famous pieces, and it's called The Flowers of the Forest. You might know this name from a folk tune of the same name. So it was actually set to that tune. And it's an early work of hers. It's supposedly about a financial crisis that happened in the area that she was from, but some also speculate that it's about a man that she was involved with at the time. We actually don't know exactly, so that only shows you how versatile this work is. I've seen the smiling of fortune beguiling. I have felt all its favors and found its decay. Sweet was its blessing, kind its caressing, but now it has fled. Fled far away. I've seen the forest adorn the foremost with flowers of the forest most pleasant and gay. So bonny was their blooming, their scent the air perfuming, but now they are withered and a weed away. I've seen the morning with gold the hills adorning and loud tempest storming before the midday. I've seen the tweed's silver stream glittering in the sunny beam grow drumly and dark as they rode on their way. Oh, fickle fortune, why this cruel sporting? Oh, why still perplex us, poor sons of the day? No more your smiles can cheer me, no more your frowns can fear me, for the flowers of the forest are a weed away. So this is surprisingly somber for someone who was so much fun, but I guess the point is, her funny poems and the quips that she wrote for other people, we wouldn't even get them because they were obviously Easter eggs for her present company. So this is what survives of her work, the more serious side of her writing. We're moving on to a woman who had a somewhat similar story, except she was maybe a little gay. So Anna Seward was also active in the 18th century, but a little later than Mrs. Alison Cockburn. So Anna's father was surprisingly forward-thinking. I'm always pleasantly surprised when I read about people that held views that were not common in the era, because it's so difficult to be thinking something else than everyone else is thinking, especially at the times when that was frowned upon so heavily, even for men. So he actually championed female education. He even published a poem called The Female Right to Education. And he taught Anna theology. He taught her numeracy, poetry, and also their house was this sort of cultural hub. They hosted a lot of writers and thinkers, and Anna could interact with them from a young age. So she began writing very young, and she just continued. She just continued writing. At some point, At some point, her dad was like, okay, that's a bit too much writing. Like, you're still a woman. But she still continued. So for now, we're reading An Evening in November in a Mountainous Country, which is very promising because I love Novembers and I love mountainous countries. Ceased is the rain, but heavy drops yet fall from the drenched roof. Yet murmurs the sunk wind round the dim hills. Yet can a passage find whistling through yon cleft rock and ruined wall. The swollen and angry torrents heard appall, though distant. A few stars, emerging kind, shed their green trembling beams. With lesser small, the moon, her swiftly passing clouds behind, glides over the shaded hill. Now blasts remove the shadowing clouds, and on the mountain's brow, full-orbed she shines. Half-sunk within its cove, heaves the lone boat with gulfing sound. And lo, bright rolls the settling lake, and brimming rove, the vale's blue rills, and glitter as they flow. Now, I did, of course, mention that Anna was a little bit fruity. This is one of those things where the academia can't outright say it, but it would honestly be very unlikely that she's not. First of all, she never married, and she was like, marriage sucks, guys. I actually don't condone this. Second of all, she had a lot of friends, both men and women, but she only seemed to be romantically interested in women. It actually seems like she had a crush on a family friend's daughter that was adopted into her family. Her name was Honora. So the family had a friend, and the friend passed away, and the friend left a daughter, and they were like, okay, let's adopt the daughter then. And a lot of Anna's works revolve around Honora, and she was apparently very displeased when Honora married and later moved to Ireland. And Anna also had a dog named Sappho. So concerning all these, like, I know historians can't be like, based on these, my gator tells me she was gay. They need actual proof, but sometimes it gets to the point where it's quite obvious. But historians, being obviously as rooted in historical proof as possible, they're always like, oh, was she or wasn't she? I guess we'll never know. So here is one of the poems that was dedicated to Honora, in which Anna praises Honora's beauty and she laments the cruelty of the passing of time. I write Honora on the sparkling sand. The envious waves forbid the trace to stay. Honora's name again adorns the strand. Again the waters bear their prize away. So nature wrote her charms upon thy face. The cheeks light bloom, the lips and vermeid dye. And every gay and every witching grace that youth's warm hours and beauty's stores supply. But time's stern tide, with cold oblivion's wave, shall soon dissolve each fair, each fading charm. Even nature's self, so powerful, cannot save her own rich gifts from this overwhelming harm. Love and the muse can boast superior power, indelible the letters they shall frame. They yield to no inevitable hour, but will on lasting tablets write thy name. Aww. Anyway, next up, we have Mary Tighe, who was an Irish poet. Now, if you think of your typical suffering 19th century poet, she is that. She was active at the beginning of the 19th century, so she is very much this classical, frail poet, riddled with consumption, as it often happens. She passed away only at the age of 37, and throughout her life, she found refuge in her writing. Her first published allegorical poem, Psyche, in 1805, got her a lot of recognition. Most of it was sadly after her passing. And now we are reading something that was written at Killarney in July 27th, 1800, like 1800 sharp. How soft the pause, the note's melodious cease, which from each feeling could an echo call. Rest on your oars, that not a sound may fall to interrupt the stillness of our peace. The fanning west wind breathes upon our cheeks, yet glowing with the sun's departed beams. Through the blue heavens, the cloudless moon pours streams of pure resplendent light in silver streaks, reflected on the still, unruffled lake. The alpine hills in solemn silence frown, while the dark woods night's deepest shades embrown. And now once more the soothing strain awake. Oh, ever to my heart with magic power shall those sweet sounds recall this rapturous hour. Genuinely, this is, I mean, this is a beautiful piece, but also it kind of sounds like when you're on a break from work and you're like, blessed silence, not a sound may fall to interrupt the stillness of our peace. And then you have to wake up and be like, okay, yeah, time's up. We're moving on to Felicia Dorothea Hemans. Surprisingly, there is a connection between her and Mary, whose poem we just read. Felicia was an admirer of Mary's work, and she actually wrote a poem that was a tribute to her, which is very nice. We love women supporting women. Felicia was born at the end of the 18th century to a family of wine merchants and diplomats. So kind of high standing, also not quite. She was born English, but as I aforementioned, she identified as Welsh since she actually spent her youth there. She spent a lot of the time in Wales. She knew and used the language as well. To be fair, she actually also knew German, French, Italian, Spanish, and Portuguese, which is genuinely impressive. Maybe not that uncommon with the women of the higher class, but even her contemporaries noted that her education was crazy good. It was very uncommon for a woman to be that educated. Her first poems dedicated to the Prince of Wales were published when she was 14. That's crazy young. Now, if you remember Text 3, an episode from years ago, I think it was maybe season 1, episode 2, you will remember Percy Bysshe Shelley and why we have beef with him. So he read the poems and he was so impressed with the poems that he actually started a correspondence with her. Luckily, it seems it was only about art, because we've been knowing he had a thing for teenagers, but to be fair, he was also a teen at the time as well. But the age gap was still there, so stay away from Felicia, Percy. But they had a whole conversation about her art, so that's pretty impressive for someone who's 14. That's crazy. She actually was very smart, because she was not just writing and then trying to sell her poems as books, which may have been not the most successful thing ever. She actually published a lot of her works in magazines first, and then people could read them, familiarize themselves with her name, and sort of know that she's good. And then when she published those collected poems as books, you know, they bought them much more eagerly because they already knew that she's good. And this allowed her to make some money and make a name for herself. And this is honestly a good business practice. So she basically built a following before publishing the book. What's crazy to me is that she was so active as a writer and as a poet, and she did so much. And at the same time, she gave birth to 5 sons in 6 years. That's absolutely crazy. So she was basically constantly pregnant, in and out of labor and postpartum, and popping out not only babies, but also absolute poetical bangers. Okay, check out this one. The summer's call. Come away, the sunny hours woo thee far to founts and bowers over the very waters now. In their play, flowers are shedding, beauty's glow. Come away, where the lily's tender gleam quivers on the glancing stream. Come away. All the air is filled with sound, soft and sultry and profound. Murmurs through the shadowy grass lightly stray. Faint winds whisper as they pass, come away. Where the bee's deep music swells from the trembling foxglove bells, come away. In the skies the sapphire blue now hath won its richest hue. In the woods the breath of song sheds a ray. Dreamy, starry, greenly bright, come away. Where the boughs with dewy gloom darken each thick bed of bloom, come away. In the deep heart of the rose, now the crimson love hue glows. Now the glowworm's lamp by night sheds a ray. Dreamy, starry, greenly bright, come away. where the fairy Cadmos lies with the wildwood strawberries, come away. Now each tree by summer crowned sheds its own rich twilight round, glancing there from sun to shade, bright wings play. There the deer its couch hath made, come away. Where the smooth leaves of the lime glisten in their honey time, come away, away. Honestly, I'm coming with you. I don't know what you want me to say. This, I said mermaid core with the first poem. This is our last poem. I'm going to say fairy core. This is so fairy coded. But it's also such a beautiful vision of this peaceful nature and just simply running away and abandoning everything and just running into the forest and running into the meadow. And I am so here for that. Like, let me just, you know what, I'm gonna take my phone because I don't want to die, and I will run with you. So now that you have listened to some of that poetry, I wonder if you agree with me that you can really tell that these were written by women. I feel like there is something about those poems and this art that speaks to the female experience. I can't quite distill it and say what it is precisely, but I'm also not saying that if I didn't know that those were written by women, I would guess it, because it's not that obvious. But combined, there is just something so whimsical about it. I don't know. It's I know that 19th century poetry in general is quite whimsical and airy, but you know, we've had poetry from other centuries and it all sounds like there is this common denominator, which I don't know what it is. Maybe you're going to help me pinpoint it, but there is definitely something going on here that's quite special, and I'm not quite sure how to call it, how to name it. But maybe you absolutely disagree. Maybe this is the worst poetry you've ever heard, in which case, like and subscribe. No, don't do that. I don't even know if that's possible with the podcast, but let me know what you think about this. I find that even if you don't like the poetry, I think the stories of these women are interesting enough and can teach us much about the female experience in the past and how historical women have fought for their place in society and in art and in poetry, as it seems. Because I'm assuming even though a majority of them was quite rich and powerful, they still had to fight for themselves, because that was not a usual thing for a woman to do. That was just not conventional. So let me know what you think in the comments, and don't forget to check out the Patreon at patreon.com/textree, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye.